debt. It keeps you tossing and turning at night. You can't get away from it. But the truth is, the system is designed to trap you in debt. Insanely high interest credit cards and loans make it nearly impossible to pay off your debt. There's a new way out of the debt trap, Pivotal Debt Solutions. Pivotal Debt Solutions isn't like the old school debt relief companies that string your debt out for years. They have aggressive strategies that can end your debt faster and easier than you thought possible. Pivotal Debt Solutions can cut or even eliminate interest. Find programs to write off your balances so you owe less. Stop those threatening phone calls, and without bankruptcy and without a loan. Bottom line, they find every solution possible to end your debt permanently. Before you do anything, contact Pivotal Debt Solutions first. Talk to them for free. Find out how fast they can help you get out of debt. Visit zapmydebt.com. That's zapmydebt.com. Zapmydebt.com.
Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Byte Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It is a beautiful day here in Portland. I hope it is wherever you are. Tomorrow is World War II Victory in Europe Day, VE Day. Also, National Nurses Week. In fact, yesterday was National Nurses Day. This is National Nurses Week. And congratulations to them. Today is my birthday. Please, no need to wish me happy birthday when you call. It'll just burn through a lot of time. But, you know, just to get that out of the way. And there's a whole bunch of stuff that I want to share with you very quickly, but we have no guests today. It's just going to be you and me. And there is, of course, there are a lot of topics to cover, but also whatever you would like to talk about, whatever we might have missed throughout the week, whatever might be on your mind. It doesn't even have to be relevant to politics. But my rant today, the piece that I published over at HartmanReport.com, the title is, "Will Barr Get Away with Covering Up Treason for H.W. Bush, Reagan, and Now Trump?" And it's about Bill Barr and how Judge Amy Berman Jackson, day before yesterday, or maybe 2 days before yesterday, in this court ruling, based on CREW, what's CREW stand for? Responsibility and Ethics in Government, something like that. But RE is the Responsibility and Ethics part. And I think C is Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in maybe in Washington. But in any case, CREW filed the Freedom of Information Act lawsuit back when Trump was still president after the Mueller report came out, but it had not been released. Mueller released it, thinking that it would go straight to the public and everybody would go, "Oh my God, we've got to prosecute Donald Trump. Look at those 10 specific incidents of obstruction of justice. Any normal person would be in prison for this." And what was he obstructing justice around? The fact that he was trying to collude with the Russians and that they had helped him win the election. And that, you know, I think America would have been aghast and Trump would have been prosecuted had Bill Barr not stopped us from seeing that thing for about a month and then come out in public in front of the American people. Remember when Congress called him to testify? The report still was not public. Even the redacted version still was not public. He lied to Congress. He lied to the media. He lied to you and me. I mean, these are all crimes. But what he was doing was he was lying to cover up the crimes of Donald Trump. And it turns out that Bill Barr has a long history of this. You go back to the 1980s and, you know, Ronald Reagan cut a deal with the Iranians. President Bonnie Sauter, the guy who was president of Iran at the time, told the Christian Science Monitor in 2013, and there's a link to that actual article with the president of Iran saying this in my piece today over at HartmanReport.com. He said, quote, Ayatollah Khomeini and Ronald Reagan had organized a clandestine negotiation, later known as the October Surprise, which prevented the attempts by myself and then U.S. President Jimmy Carter to free the hostages before the 1980 U.S. presidential election took place. The fact that they were not released tipped the results of the election in favor of Reagan. End quote. So that's what the president, the guy who was the president of Iran in 1980, during the election, during the campaign when Ronald Reagan was running against Jimmy Carter. And, you know, you go back and you look at the polling, and right up until the last couple months, Carter was way ahead of Reagan. But then Carter had his disastrous attempt to free the hostages. The helicopter went down in the desert. It got covered, you know, all across America. Those of you who remember 1980, all across America, people were tying yellow ribbons to trees and putting them on the front door of their houses. I mean, it was a thing. It was all over the country. And when Carter's attempt failed, that was functionally the end of the Carter presidency. And it turns out that this was something that had been organized by the Ronald Reagan for President campaign with the Ayatollah Khomeini, the head of Iran. And the president of Iran has come out and said so. Well, Lawrence Walsh had been appointed special prosecutor in 1986 by Congress, and he was looking into this. It was called Iran-Contra. We would sell them weapons if they would hold the hostages, and then we took the money from selling them weapons and used that to illegally buy weapons and send them to the Contras down in Nicaragua and also to mess with Guatemala and El Salvador, things that Congress had specifically passed laws forbidding Ronald Reagan from doing. He did it anyway. I mean, we're talking about breaking major laws passed by Congress. So who, and you know, the investigation by Lawrence Walsh started in 1986. Reagan left office in 88, and, well, actually, January of 89, and January 20th, specifically. And, like, within a week of his leaving office, we got the announcement that he had Alzheimer's and he would never again be seen publicly. I mean, I think he might have made one overseas trip during that first couple of weeks. Maybe it was a couple of weeks, but it was very, very quickly after he left. And so now we've got President George Herbert Walker Bush. Lawrence Walsh is continuing his investigation. He continues it through the 4 years of the Bush presidency. Bush refuses to turn over any documents to him that might have helped his investigation. Casper Weinberger, who had been the defense secretary for Trump, or for Reagan, refused to turn over anything. Ollie North refused to turn over anything. I mean, you had this cast of characters, and they had already convicted several of them of crimes. Elliot Abrams, he was looking at going to prison. Ollie North, looking at going to prison. Casper Weinberger, looking to go to prison. And so George Herbert Walker Bush, then Lawrence Walsh, the prosecutor, subpoenaed George Herbert, then President Bush's diary, his campaign diary from the 1980 campaign. And he wanted to see, you know, did you have any contacts with Iran too? And Bush said, no, I'm not going to give that to you. And this came to a head the week of Christmas of 1992. This is 7 weeks after Bush has lost the election to Clinton, and 5 weeks before Clinton's going to be sworn in as president. So Bush is still president, but he's lost the election. It's in the lame duck period. So he goes to Bill Barr and he says, what do I do? How do I avoid going to prison for treason and revealing the treason of Ronald Reagan? And Bill Barr in 2001 told some report, you know, this university was doing an oral history of the Bush and Trump and Reagan administrations. And Barr came right out and said, it was my suggestion. Pardon everybody. That will shut down the investigation. which is not only what Trump did on his way out of town, but that's what George Herbert Walker Bush did. And thus you had this screaming headline across the top of the New York Times. I reprint the actual, kind of a photo of the New York Times in my article over at HartmanReport.com. Bush pardons six in Iran affair, averting a Weinberger trial, prosecutor assails cover-up. And then the subhead, Bush diary at issue. And then below that, six-year inquiry into deal of arms for hostages all but swept away. So the question, do you think, Joe Biden, President Biden has said, hey, if we're gonna go after anybody, that's not up to me, it's up to Merrick Garland. So is Merrick Garland gonna go after Bill Barr? For that matter, is he gonna go after Donald Trump? It looks like he is. But whether Bill Barr is in his sights or not, I don't know. But I just thought I'd raise the question because it's something that, it's really worth talking about. I tweeted it out this morning, too. It's over on our Facebook page, too, if you want to check it out. Whatever is on your mind, we can discuss. We've got to get into the unemployment claims. I got a bunch of other stuff. We'll sprinkle it through the show. Martin in Greensboro, North Carolina. Hey, Martin, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. Great show. Really great topics. I love your coverage. I wanted to celebrate the accomplishments of NASA just recently with the Perseverance rover. I just thought it was incredibly inspiring, that landing in February, and just everything about that mission. They've named the landing site Octavia Butler Landing Site. The Ingenuity helicopter just flew, and they just completed an experiment that proves they can create oxygen out of the atmosphere in Mars for future crewed landings. And I just think everything about that mission has been so inspiring, and I just wanted to give them a celebratory shout-out.
I'm with you. The other thing that I find fascinating is that they're discovering that apparently there's a large quantity of water on the planet buried under the ground, and which again means that at one point there was probably life on the planet, but beyond that, that if we were to try to land humans there, we could have access to water as well as you pointed out, we could concentrate oxygen out of the atmosphere.
Exactly.
It still would be a very,
oxygen,
very
water,
hostile place.
Everything. That's very true, but I just think it would be fascinating to actually send people to another planet if we get around
yes.
to that.
I
think it'd be
I agree.
Great.
I'm with you. Martin, thank you. Thank you. Excellent homage to NASA. Jessica in Chicago. Hey, Jessica, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. I want to wish you a very happy birthday. But
thank
can
you,
we get the Trump baby balloon in Arizona? The sore losers just continue to want to recount over and over. And I wish I could go to Arizona and protest with a poster saying, wah, 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 boo, hoo, hoo,
yeah.
Hey, sore losers. Your community is losing over 100,000 for the stupidity. And so one other thing. Yesterday, the first thing Rep. Elise Stefanik does is go on Steve Bannon's show to talk about the Arizona ninja counting and how they need to find 40,000 ballots from China. But it makes sense that the Republicans want to replace Cheney with Stefanik because she spoke for a half hour to stop the count of the ballots at the Capitol on January 6th, saying the election was stolen. And I sent an email to Rachel Maddow. I want to send it to you. I saved a screenshot. Rep. Elise Stefanik said, and it started out, it said, real results, and then it had a little hammer emoji, and then it, right before it said, we the people. So she's using the hammer emoji like the Proud Boys and the Oath Keepers use. She's part of, it's a Nazi little symbol, that hammer that they used. But for your birthday gift, I wanted to say one last thing. I want to leave you with a really good laugh. The wax figure on display of the idiot Trump at the Louis Trudeau's Wax Museum in Texas was being punched so much by everybody that they had to move it to protect it. And I'm thinking, yes, and too bad they couldn't just put it behind bars already.
Yeah, I remember the story. And Jessica, I think this whole thing with Stefanik is, it's being treated by the media like it's kind of a joke. Well, and what's going on in Arizona, it's being treated by the media like it's a joke. Mm-hmm. There's a reason why we really, really need to take this super seriously, what's going on in Arizona, even though the feds are going to come in and probably shut it down if the high school proms do it before that. But what they're doing in state after state, I mean, again, the law that DeSantis signed in Florida yesterday allows partisan elected officials to decide who won the election, not professionals, just like the law in Georgia allows the Republicans who control the state legislature to decide who won the election, regardless of what the ballots say. So now you have two states. I believe we have a three. I believe this is true of Iowa as well. So maybe we have three states, and they're working on doing this in Arizona. By 2024, I'm guessing we're going to have at least 15, maybe 20 states where the outcome of the election doesn't depend on how the voters voted. It depends on what the Republicans who control the state are going to say is the outcome of the election. And so all of this stuff that looks like high theater and absurdity, which is being used to justify these kinds of laws, that's going to go away and be replaced by basically, the government saying, well, the new protectors of the election. It won't be the Secretary of State any longer, at least in Georgia, because he got pushed out of the way. But whoever's in charge of the elections now will be telling people in the states. And that is, in my mind, the setup for stealing the 2024 presidential election from presumably Kamala Harris. And handing it to whoever the Republicans nominate, and I'm guessing it'll be one of their more neo-fascist candidates. Probably Rick Scott, possibly Ron DeSantis. I think it's a remote chance. Possibly Tom Cotton or Josh Hawley or one of those guys. Even possibly Nikki Haley or the woman who is the governor of South Dakota. Her name is escaping me at the moment, but. One of those folks, I really think that they're preparing to steal the elections in 2024. That's what this is all about. They're willing to put up with being ridiculed, and they're willing to put up with all the difficulties because this is the long game. They're playing the long game here. So we need to be very careful. Jessica, thanks. Thanks for calling, and thanks for pointing all that out. Appreciate the call. Scott in Portland. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Hey, they stole my thunder. I was going to do the shout out to JPL and NASA and the Ingenuity. But I will say this, that I think that the first image that came back from the Ingenuity, which was a shadow on the surface, is going to be one of those iconic, like the Earthrise images of a moment that's, it's sort of ethereal there. You don't really see the orbiter. You don't see the mm-hmm. the device. You see its shadow, and that sort of tells a story about it. Just the fact that there's a shadow on the surface implies all this other. It's kind of like the
of Mars
from the Apollo 11. Yeah. It's like the Apollo 11 shot. That was just a full shot of the boot print on the surface. Mm-hmm. We've all seen. And again, it's kind of like you don't see the boot. And the image of the impression on the surface of the lunar surface sort of tells the whole story, and I think it's going to go down in history as being one of those sort of wonderful things that this are non-political. And I remember as a 12-year-old sitting in front of my parents' TV watching Neil Armstrong come down the limb. In that grainy black and white image, and just thinking, in 5 years we're going to be living on the moon, and didn't quite work out that way. But I think we're now seeing that the inertia is there to make things happen. And what you're talking about with the water, the same as on the moon, there's an extraordinary amount of frozen ice water in the surface of the moon. So basically, all we got to do is go up and put a dome, and the water will start condensing out.
Yeah. It's there's so much possibility in all these areas, and for me, the big message, Scott, the thing that that you know, we need to be emphasizing over and over and over again, is that Earth is a, you know, it's this little marble in space where it, we have exactly. one planet. And we're, you know, as we pour pollution and carbon and whatever into the atmosphere, we're pouring, you know, we're polluting our whole entire planet. Nothing's local, and nothing is leaving, by the way, the Earth. So, you know, our all of our waste and all of our poisons, they're not ending up on the moon. They're ending up right back here. And
how
hopefully
many people,
that, that
how
message.
How many people are we going to put on the moon? How many people are we going to put on Mars? You know, it's just, it's interesting.
Yeah, it's certainly not going to be the entire human race. Yeah, absolutely. Scott, thanks a lot for the call. It's a great one. Omar in Herndon, Virginia. Hey, Omar, what's on your mind today?
Tom, thanks so much for taking my call. Just to go back to your rant earlier at the beginning of the show, I always thought that Bill Bell was playing with fire. So, I mean, is he going to get prosecuted now?
He has a long history of it.
Exactly. You know, and I think he, you know, since he was playing with fire, I think the Trump administration should certainly go after him and prosecute him for everything that he did, you know, and that might lead us to Trump. But what I wanted to call about is that we need to continue to push for the $15 minimum wage. You know, the minimum wage is the only thing that inflation never $15 minimum wage never touched. Kept up with inflation. It never touched. It always stayed the same, and I think it's way due. And the thing is that if you make the minimum wage, you should not pay any federal or state taxes. That would help with poverty. You know, we always talk about we want war on poverty. This is the best weapon and tool. You know, give people $15 an hour, make it tax-free. It would help people, especially coming off this pandemic.
Well, this is, you know, the I believe it's called the American Jobs Plan. No, that's the next one. The last one, the American Rescue Plan. You know, the COVID bill that got passed like a month or so ago. That has tax breaks for average citizens that are so extensive. These are the largest tax cuts for people making under $75,000 in the history of the country. Most people making under $75,000 will discover a year from now, next April, that they don't owe any taxes, any federal taxes, which is mind-boggling when you think about it.
Absolutely.
So I'm with you. Omar, thank you. Thank you very much for the call. It's great to hear from you. We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Our book today in the Tom Hartman Book Club is Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. It's by Vince Houghton. This is from the introduction. This is a book about desperation. That word has been so overused and misused that it's lost much of its impact. Too many stories about some local sports team desperate for a win or some housewives desperate for whatever that show is about. These pretenders have trivialized a word designed to be used only in the most extraordinary of circumstances. It should be a powerful word reserved for the urgent and overwhelming feeling that one's life is at risk. It's for the truly existential threats, another misused word, to one's country, one's family, one's friends, or one's livelihood. To feel desperate is to believe there are no good options, that everything that has been tried or could be tried is destined for failure. Desperation leads us to consider ideas that would have been unfathomable under normal circumstances, because desperate people make desperate decisions. This is also a book about innovation. Creative thinking about how things work and the possibilities of how things could work has been the catalyst for the astonishingly dynamic technological transformation of the past 100 years. From the advent of lighter-than-air flight to hypersonic aircraft, from bolt-action rifles to electromagnetic railguns, from ENIAC to quantum computing, from one poor freezing soldier in a trench listening to intercepted wireless messages to the NSA's supercomputers collecting the metadata of billions, brilliant people with innovative ideas continue to shape our world and do it exponentially faster than the generations that came before. But when innovation and desperation meet, trouble will usually follow. If necessity is the mother of invention, desperation is the drunk uncle, the guy who only calls twice a year at 3 a.m. on your birthday with the greatest idea anyone has ever had. No matter how hard you argue against the logic of his narrative, no matter how many flaws you find in his reasoning, he's resolute. This will work. It has to. He's a desperate man. Every so often, we're surprised when one of these ideas actually pans out. The U-2 and SR-71 spy planes, some of the most innovative aircraft ever designed, were the result of American desperation to see inside the Soviet Union. Nuclear power, computers, the internet, modern textiles, personal encryption, even the process of how some of our food is grown, were born out of the nation's desperate fear to keep pace with an imposing rival. Much of that history has been written before. Countless books have been published about the remarkable and successful technology developed over the last century by governments for national security needs. This is not one of them. Most history books are full of stories that happened. This is a history book full of stories behind things that didn't happen. Here we'll take an expansive look at projects, missions, operations, and technology that were seriously considered but didn't make the grade. Some were ultimately deemed too risky, expensive, dangerous, ahead of their time, or even certifiably insane. Others were canceled mostly because they were overtaken by events. The atomic bomb worked, the war ended, the plans were captured, other technology superseded. Generally, history books use events of the past to make powerful arguments about historical actors' motivations, personalities, and states of mind. And rightfully so, this is part of what history books are supposed to do. But I contend that the evaluation of historical events is not enough. It can be just as important to investigate policies, decisions, and technologies that were considered at the highest levels, but then nixed for a variety of reasons. The intent of historical actors can be, and I argue is, far more instructive and illuminating than focusing entirely on the outcome of their policies. Outcome history is the traditional way of viewing historical events, but it leaves much to be desired. It has severe limitations, primarily because its lessons are predicated on things that can't be accurately quantified. Fate, luck, misfortune, whatever you want to call it. If the D-Day invasion of Normandy had failed because of a freak weather system, or a lucky shot from a German soldier that took out a key American leader on the beach, or any number of other misfortunate scenarios, would we think any less of Eisenhower's plan? Using outcome-based history, the answer is yes. And therein lies the problem. Intent can be a very powerful tool for historians. So leave your historical hindsight at the door. Ignore the fact that these policies, technologies, programs, and missions were scrapped before they became real. To get the most out of this book, you should take the advice of Master Yoda. You must unlearn what you have learned. The outcomes of the programs are inconsequential to the overall message of the narrative. Outcome really doesn't matter here at all. That's why this book scorns the counterfactual, the game of what if, vilifies it, mocks it mercilessly. The counterfactual is our enemy. We will not what-if ourselves until we are blue in our faces trying to rewrite history into a hodgepodge of ahistorical nonsense. Deep breath. I might have taken that a little too far. Counterfactuals can be a lot of fun when you're hanging out with your friends and family debating the what-ifs of the Kennedy assassination, or the Civil War, or the Protestant Reformation, or the Star Wars prequels, or the 1986 World Series. I forgive you, Bill Buckner, mostly. I'd be happy to join you all one day for a vigorous debate on historical counterfactuals, perhaps over your favorite adult beverage or bottle of Yoo-hoo, but they have no place here. Instead, all of these stories should have you saying, what were they thinking? The best way to approach this book is with an open mind toward the decision makers and how they were approaching the problems facing them. In almost every case, those in power were desperate to do something, anything, to combat their adversaries. Thus, what were they thinking is exactly correct. Except I hope you'll be willing to truly embrace the question and not just see it as the dismissive aside or a hasty pejorative. nuking the moon and other intelligence schemes. Our book for the day. And welcome back. Katie in Australia. Hey, Katie, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Hello, I'm Katie in Hamul in Australia.
Where in Australia are you, Katie?
We're south of Perth in a little lovely little town called Fremantle. My husband's from Sydney, but we're in Fremantle. So I know you've been in Perth before.
Yeah. So you're over there by the Indian Ocean on the far west side of the country. Yeah. That's beautiful country.
Absolutely. Yeah. I send you the sun every sunset. I send it over to San Diego. But anyway, yeah, no, I've sent you a couple emails regarding what's going on in Australia. And actually, we go back and forth, my husband being Australian, but when I landed here, it was the beginning of COVID. So I've been on the front line of a country that handled it extremely, extremely well. And as you mentioned before, you had a caller last week this week, it's a little late here, it's past midnight, and who mentioned that there was a prime minister, or he thought it was a current prime minister, who talked about, who told the truth about the Murdoch family, in absolutely pulled no punches. And you didn't know about it. We knew about it here. And I sent you an email saying, here's what that gentleman was referring to. And he had CNN, that. Actually.
Was it? So it wasn't Kevin Rudd. Who was it?
No, it wasn't Kevin Rudd. And this can update your, because you do always refer to Kevin Rudd's excellent article that's getting, you know, a little long in the tooth. And it was Malcolm Fraser.
The Republican.
The
conservative.
You know, we call liberal, but he's a conservative. And it's in the Financial Review. In fact, the link that I sent you, hoping that it would just be up, you would upload it to your newsletter, was a video. But this is in the Financial Review, and I think I'll probably just send it to you. It's called Turnbull Unloads on, quote, lying, end quote, News Corp.
Go for it.
This is what he says. One of the things he says, I'm picking out anything here. News Corp now is like a political party, but with just one member or one family of members, and that is an absolute threat to our democracy, he said. Turnbull said.
Yeah.
This is the fundamental problem, going on to quote him, that we're facing. The most powerful political actor in Australia is not the Liberal Party, his Conservative Party, or the National Party, or the Labor Party. It is News Corp, and it is utterly unaccountable.
It's true here too.
Fabulous.
Katie, when was he Prime Minister? I don't know the lineage, you know, the order of Prime Ministers there.
He was the one before this dreadful Morrison, Scotty Morrison.
Before
that we
Morrison.
Have.
So he's the immediate past prime minister. He's the most recent.
I think he's the immediate. There may have been, you know, they do different terms. There may have been an abbot in there. But he's a very active politician. And
very
an excellent for you to, to quote.
Well,
for
the conservatives are turning on the Murdochs. You know something real is going on. Katie, I'm out of time, but thank you. Thanks for the call, and I look forward to the note. Thank you again. I just want to make one quick note, because it's kind of at the top of the news and everybody's talking about it, about the unemployment claims. They were expecting that today's jobs report that would come out from the Labor Department would indicate, or maybe this Treasury, I think it's Labor, would indicate that there was probably, you know, a million new jobs created in April. And it turns out that it was only 200 and something, a little over 200,000. don't have the exact number right here in front of me in this article. And that's supposed to hurt the stock market, and that's supposed to indicate that Biden and the recovery aren't doing so well. I mean, this is what you're going to hear on right-wing talk radio today, right? Oh, this is proof that Biden's stimulus really didn't work, and the Republicans were right, we should have done nothing at all, and why all this big spending? And people won't work, you know, but they're getting too much money from the unemployment benefits, and quack, 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 right? This is the right-wing take on the fact that fewer than 300,000 new jobs were created in April. The reality, just so, you know, the next time one of your right-wing friends or neighbors or relatives or Facebook buddies or whatever throws that out, the reality is that people are still afraid to go back to work because there's still disease running around out there because of the Republicans and the mask holes, number one. Not everybody's vaccinated. Only about half of us are vaccinated. So, number one, there's still fear. Number two, there are still a lot of people who can't go back to work, particularly women, although there's men in this category as well. Whoever's going to be the principal caregiver for their children in the family can't go back to work because the schools are not yet open in a lot of places, and most daycare is still not open at all. So you've got a lot of parents who just simply can't go back to work. And then you've got some older workers, because the stock market has gone up so much, and a lot of people were a lot smarter than me, and they invested in the stock market after the crash in 2008, and they've got so much money now that they're just retiring in their late 50s and in their 60s. And God bless them. But, so you've got those folks who are just not interested in going back into the labor market. You've got some younger workers who have decided to look at different professions. They're going into other new fields, which shrinks the general labor pool. And a lot of employers are still trying to hire people at crap wages. You know, $2.15 an hour for servers. And you wonder why restaurants are complaining that they can't hire servers. $7.25 an hour for minimum wage workers, and you wonder why, you know, restaurant or why businesses are saying, hey, nobody wants to work. Yeah, nobody wants to work for that kind of money. Are you kidding? Particularly after a whole year of a conversation about $15 minimum wages. So anyhow, I just wanted to put that out there so you have it and you know, and we're all well informed. Chaz in Lakewood, Washington. Hey, Chaz, what's on your mind today?
Bonjour, mon ami.
Hey. Always a new language. What's up?
Yeah, you're the one that inspired. Anyhow, all right. The first time I heard about COVID-19, Tom, was on your program. Even then, you seemed to consider the potential impact ominously. And I had a feeling at the beginning of He Who Shall Not Be Mentioned's term that deaths were possible and that democracy itself could be at peril. I didn't say it out loud because the whole notion just seemed so preposterous at the time. But we were subject to every day being a crisis of the day until we grew deaf from crisis fatigue. And then we came so close to losing it all in the election of 2020. And now I find myself reveling that things are normal again. This is a historical moment in time, Tom. Our children will be telling the story to their grandchildren that 2 years of our lives were just ripped away. COVID-19, as in 2019. How flagrantly stupid is this? We had to endure so much unnecessary suffering. Now they're saying it might be even 900,000 deaths. Such a horrific blemish on American exceptionalism. We could have led the world once again out of the darkest epoch of our lifetimes. No, we led the world in COVID deaths. To wrap up, we went to war over 3,000 deaths from 9/11. If someone came and killed 900,000 Americans, we would have scorched and salted the earth to root them out of their spider holes. 100,000. Listen, right. Kid.
And 400,000 of those deaths, we know for sure. And that's out of the 500,000, right? 400,000, in other words, about 80% of them were deaths that were completely unnecessary. They were because, you know, Trump and Kushner were so incompetent, or because they simply chose not to do anything about it because they thought it was mostly killing black people in blue states.
So hang on to your masks and vaccination cards. Pass them down as heirlooms, and don't ever let our legacy once again include terror, insurrection, and death. Thanks, Tom.
Amen. Thanks, Chez. Great rant. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Happy birthday, Tom.
Well, thank you.
We just had May 3rd, which is the World Press Freedom Day, designated by the United Nations. And then Reporters Without Borders came out with their World Press Freedom Index, which is ranking the U.S. 44th in the world in terms of press freedom this year.
Oh, my.
So it's the 30th anniversary.
Isn't that tragic? I mean, were there guys who invented that concept back in the 1770s?
It's been slipping since early 2000s, but we were at 48th last year. So some of the countries have actually gotten worse, let's put it that way. But it was the 30th anniversary of the adoption of the Windhoek Declaration that was drafted during the World Press Freedom Day proceedings in Namibia. So this year, the World Press Freedom Day events were again held in Namibia, with most of the events taking place online. And as executive director for Democracy Watch News, you know, it's my job to track these press freedom issues around the world. So I participated in that conference along
good
with
on
the
you,
National
Mark.
Press Club event. What's that?
I said, good on you, Mark.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a big issue for me. Along with the National Press Club, they also held an event. So we got to talk to some great people, especially also during the International Symposium on Online Journalism. This all took place over the last week. So we got to talk to A.G. Sulzberger, the publisher of the New York Times, Marty Baron from the Washington Post, Catherine Viner, the editor-in-chief of The Guardian. And some of the themes this year were the development of new journalism, because there are a lot of new nonprofits like my organization that are out there trying to change the face of journalism. There's also a lot of talk about the protection of female journalists, because the International Women's Media Foundation reported that a study showed that 70% of female journalists have been reported being harassed online, usually from men. And then we also had a lot of sessions on how to talk about the disinformation and how to deal with it and counter the massive amount of disinformation coming out of, so-called news organizations and then these social media platforms. And then we also talked a lot about the application of virtual reality and augmented reality to journalism, which I think is going to be the big cutting edge thing that is going to be happening. We got to work with one of the head technologists from the New York Times on that. And I think journalists are going to start to embrace that pretty quickly here, Tom, and you'll see a lot of VR and augmented reality projects that are organized by journalists, because it'll help us tell the story. It'll bring you right into that village in Namibia where we're doing this story, so we can place
Mark,
you.
Mark, was any of this, did anybody from the Murdoch Empire participate in any of these events?
Not at all.
Not from their Australian, their British, or their American components?
Yeah, as far as the ISOJ, there were 132 countries represented. There were like 7,300 people that had registered.
So this is mostly countries, not press companies. So when we heard from the head of the Washington Post and the New York Times, we didn't hear from the head of Fox News or the publisher of the Times of London or the various newspapers, the Australian, that Murdoch, I believe he owns the Australian in Australia. We didn't hear from them.
No, we did get a really great session from Catherine Viner from The Guardian, but nope, we didn't hear about that. And by the way, The Guardian's model, their contribution model, is doing quite well. They actually are one of the most sustainable news organizations right now, which is really, really a great, great thing.
Yeah, a lot of people are moving to that. A lot of people in the journalism and near the journalism business are moving to, we'll give you free content, and if you can afford, please kick in a little for a subscription. And I subscribe to the Guardian, for example, even though it's available online for free. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a very good thing. Mark Taylor Canfield. Mark, thanks. Keep up the great work. Tim in Aloha, Oregon. Hey, Tim, what's on your mind?
Tom, you've gone over a few things that I wanted to say, but I watched the news conference this morning with Biden, and basically he wanted to, because that jobs report, it was 266,000 jobs, so that's the number. But he's basically saying, we're in this for the long haul. We can't expect things to change overnight, but, it's remarkable what has been accomplished just in the last 4 months. And one aspect of this that a lot of people aren't pursuing like they should, some of the Michael Beschloss and Doris Kearns Goodwin, these presidential historians that you see on most of the cable channels, is where do you think we would be right now if Trump would have been reelected and the Republicans were in control of the House and the Senate? Where do you think we'd be? You talk about
right, and we had just continued to do basically nothing. I mean, Trump ordered 100 million doses of vaccine, enough to provide a first vaccination to a little less than a third of Americans. And then Pfizer came back and said, "Hey, you want to buy a second 100 million?" And Trump said, "No, not interested. Go away."
The pandemic, the economy, voters' rights. Can you imagine where we'd be right now?
We would not be a functioning republic any longer, Tim, if Trump had been able to hold on to the White House.
People have to be reminded
of that. That's how close we were.
Oh, and by the way,
I'm with you.
Today is your birthday?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, mine's the 17th. My best friend is the 10th. And guess who was 90 years old yesterday?
Who's
that? Willie Mays.
Wow. I guess 17th wouldn't be Taurus, but a lot of, around there. And one of my brothers has his birthday tomorrow. Sean's was yesterday. Another brother is next week. It's like, for us,
I'm an identical twin, and we missed Gemini by 3 days because 17th is Taurus. Willie Mays. Well, I met him after a baseball game in 1962 in San Francisco.
Really?
Yes. Quite an amazing thing, and he's born the same month as I would. He's the last, he's the only surviving, of the oldest surviving baseball player now that's in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
Pretty
that's
amazing.
That's wonderful. I did not realize that Willie Mays was even still alive. He's 90. That's incredible. Tim, I need to move along, but thank you.
Right.
And thanks for all of that. There's a lot packed into that call. Fred in La Porte, Indiana. Hey, Fred, what's on your mind?
Yeah, Tom, I talked to you before. I got sucked into making a contribution to an outfit that said they were a Congress and Senate watchdog, and come to find out it was a right-wing Republican thing, and I'm still kicking myself for not checking it out.
Hey, it happens to the best of us, Fred.
Now, I got something else here, and here's they really make you feel good. I've been selected to represent a representative of Indiana for the 2021 Senior Rights Survey, and this is an outfit, the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare, which was founded in 1982 by former Congressman James Roosevelt, son of President Franklin Roosevelt, signer of the law that created Social Security. Pretty good credentials. Mm-hmm. How true is it?
It may well be true. I can't tell you because I've never really dug into that before, Fred. But I know that Franklin Roosevelt's son or grandson has been active in trying to preserve Social Security and Medicare. The group that I support is SocialSecurityWorks.org. And they're doing some really great work and very aggressively. These fundraising mail things that I get, with here's your membership card or, all this kind of stuff that really kind of worked back years ago for direct mail and still does, I suppose, with the boomer demographic and the generation that's just a little bit older than the boomers who are aging out quickly. I tend not to respond to that kind of stuff because it just, it seems like they're spending money to get money, and I'm really far more interested in the groups like Social Security Works that are doing, they're doing some publishing work. I think they just published a book on Social Security. We have Alex on our program regularly, who I think he's the executive director or the co-executive director of Social Security Works. Yeah. And so there's some good groups out there. But you're wise, Fred, to vet anything you get from anybody these days, because you just never know. I mean, it might have been started, back in 82 by a great guy, and then he died, and then it got taken over, and then the Koch Foundation took it in or something. I mean, it could be anything.
That's what I'm afraid of. I'm 81, and I'm supposed to be feeble-minded, and I'm not quite yet. But there's so many scams going on that I just, I'm almost afraid to do anything anymore.
Yeah. Well, with things like that, you can always plug them into a search engine and dig three or four levels deep. Sometimes the first couple things that come up are
computer, but it seemed to be legitimate. But I looked up something else I talked to you about, of course, the demise of democracy going into dictatorship. And you explained that to me.
Yeah. Be careful. You're wise to be skeptical, Fred. If you want a good Social Security supporting organization. Check out socialsecurityworks.org. They're online. You should be able to check them out. Fred, I got to run. Thanks for the call. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. With higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR, all into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. It's accessible from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/Hartman with two N's. netsuite.com/Hartman. That's netsuite.com/Hartman.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/Wondery.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Our book today for the Tom Hartman Book Club is A Woman of No Importance, The Untold Story of the American Spy Who Helped Win World War II by Sonia Pernell. This is from the prologue. France was falling. Burned out cars, once strapped high with treasured possessions, were nosed crazily into ditches. Their beloved cargoes of dolls, clocks, and mirrors lay smashed around them and along mile upon mile of unfriendly road. Their owners, young and old, sprawled across the hot dust and were groaning or already silent. Yet the hordes just kept streaming past them, a never-ending line of hunger and exhaustion, too fearful to stop for days on end. 10 million women, children, and old men were on the move, all fleeing Hitler's ranks, pouring across the border from the east and the north. Entire cities had uprooted themselves in a futile bid to escape the Nazi blitzkrieg that threatened to engulf them. The fevered talk was of German soldiers stripped to the waist in jubilation at the ease of their conquest. The air was thick with smoke and the stench of the dead. The babies had no milk, and the aged fell where they stood. The hordes, drawing overladen old farm carts, sagged and snarled in their sweat-drenched agony. The French heat wave of May 1940 was witness to this, the largest refugee exodus of all time. Day after day, a solitary moving vehicle weaved its way through the crowd with a striking young woman at the wheel. Private Virginia Hall often ran low on fuel and medicines, but still pressed on in her French Army ambulance toward the advancing enemy. She persevered even when the German Strukas came screaming down to drop 110-pound bombs onto the convoys all around her, torching the cars and cratering the roads. Even when fighter planes swept over the treetops to machine gun the ditches where women and children were trying to take cover from the carnage. Even though French soldiers were deserting their units, abandoning their weapons, and running away, some in their tanks. Even when her left hip was shot with pain from continually pressing down on the clutch with her prosthetic foot. Now, at the age of 34, her mission marked the turning point after years of cruel rejection. For her own sake, as much as for the casualties she was picking up from the battlefields and ferrying to the hospital, she could not fail again. There were many reasons why she was willingly jeopardizing her life far from home in aid of a foreign country when millions of others were giving up. Perhaps foremost among them was that it had been so long since she had felt so thrillingly alive. Disgusted with the cowardice of the deserters, she could not understand why they would not continue the fight. But then, she had little to lose. The French still remembered sacrificing a third of their young menfolk to the Great War, and a nation of widows and orphans were in no mood for more bloodshed. Virginia, though, intended to go on the road, wherever the battle took her. She was prepared to take whatever risks, face down any dangers. Total war against the Third Reich might perversely offer her one last hope of personal peace. Yet even this was as nothing compared with what was to come in a life that drew out into a Homeric tale of adventure, action, and seemingly unfathomable courage. Virginia Hall's service in the France of summer 1940 was merely an apprenticeship for a near-suicide mission against the tyranny of the Nazis and their puppeteers in France. She helped to pioneer a daredevil role in espionage, sabotage, and subversion behind enemy lines in an era where women barely featured in the prism of heroism, when their part in combat was confined to the supportive and the palliative, when they were just expected to look nice and act obedient and let the men do the heavy lifting. When disabled women, or men, were confined to staying at home and leading often narrow, unsatisfying lives. The fact that a young woman who had lost her leg in tragic circumstances broke through the tightest constrictions and overcame prejudice and even hostility to help the Allies win the Second World War is astonishing. That a female guerrilla leader of her stature remains so little known to this day is incredible. Yet that is perhaps how Virginia would have wanted it. She operated in the shadows, and that was where she was happiest, even to her closest allies in France. She seemed to have no home or family or regiment, merely a burning desire to defeat the Nazis. They knew neither her real name nor her nationality, nor how she had arrived in their midst. Constantly changing in looks and demeanor, surfacing without notice across whole swaths of France, only to disappear again as suddenly, she remained an enigma throughout the war, and in some ways after it, too. Even now, tracing her story has involved 3 solid years of detective work, taking me from the National Archives in London, the Resistance Files in Lyon, and the parachute drop zones in the Haute-Leur, to the judicial dossiers of Paris and even the white marble corridors of CIA headquarters at Langley. My search led me through 9 levels of security clearance into the heart of today's world of American espionage. I have discussed the pressures of operating in enemy territory with a former member of Britain's special services and ex-intelligence officers from both sides of the Atlantic. I've tracked down files that were missing and discovered that others remained mysteriously lost or unaccounted for. I have spent days drawing diagrams matching dozens of code names with scores of her missions, months hunting for remaining extracts of these strange disappeared papers, years digging out forgotten documents and memoirs. The book, A Woman of No Importance, by Sonia Purnell.
Just a couple of quick news things, and then I'll pick up your phone calls. It turns out that we find another reason why Donald Trump might be so pissed off with Liz Cheney. It turns out that Liz Cheney was the person who organized the letter signed by her father and every other living former Secretary of Defense, urging, this was during the Trump presidency when Trump was trying to contest the election, urging the military not to get involved. You recall, Michael Flynn was giving public speeches saying that the military, he being a former general, that the military needed to seize control of the ballot boxes. Had that happened under Trump's direction, and you'll recall, right after he lost the election, Trump basically decapitated the senior Pentagon officials. That's how we ended up with Christopher, what's his name, the guy who wrote the memo, Christopher Miller, I think his name was, the guy who wrote the January 4th memo that said on January 6th, the D.C. National Guard could not help the Capitol Police. Remember that? That was one of the guys that Trump put into place immediately after he lost the election. So Liz Cheney organized this letter to be signed by these, 20-some-odd people who were still alive, who had been former defense secretaries or directly involved in that chain of command. And this could be the revenge as well. We don't know. And finally, one of the Capitol rioters, one of these guys, and again, we're calling these people rioters. This is the Washington Post, accused Capitol rioter. These are traitors. You know, a man accused of treason is how this should be phrased. But in any case, the accused Capitol traitor is claiming a defense of foxitis. Honest to God, the accused guy is named Anthony Antonio, and his lawyer, Joseph Hurley, went into court yesterday and claimed that his client, who is facing like years in prison, for the, you know, invading our capital and trying to overthrow our government for committing treason. This is from the Washington Post. This is a Washington Post story. Quote, Antonio's attorney, Joseph Hurley, claimed that Fox News' decision to regularly air then-President Donald Trump's false claims of mass election fraud contributed to Antonio's decision to participate in the insurrection. He said he has Foxitis. He became hooked on what I call Fox mania. This is what the lawyer for this guy is saying. It's crazy. Right. It's not crazy, actually. I mean, it's actually probably a reasonable defense. I don't think it's a reasonable defense in terms of legal terms, but, you know, it's practical in that it probably reflects reality, which is pretty sad when you think about it. Steve in St. Petersburg, Florida. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, you're the deepest talk show host in the world, so I figure you can handle this, what I'm going to say. I was fortunate enough to walk into Europe as an illegal American alien, and I just stayed and worked in the underground economy in several different countries, the UK, the Netherlands, Switzerland. I also was an illegal immigrant in Canada. And in all of those countries, when I got sick, and in one case, when I was hit by a car, guess how much my health care cost?
Zero, or that's five
correct.
Bucks.
Yeah. Zero, and nobody shamed me for being an illegal. And the right. quality of care, the morale and expertise of the doctors and other medical professionals was absolutely through the roof compared yeah. to the American medical system. I have one other point to make, and I hope someday you will wax philosophical, because I know you have studied spirituality, religion, theosophy, philosophy. In looking at America now, I've gone back and reread Plato's Republic. I've read Nietzsche, Voltaire, and all of them talk about a point where a populace is majority ignorant, selfish, greedy, short-sighted, and venal, so that if you gave them a democracy, they wouldn't make the right choices.
Right, that was Socrates' argument against democracy.
In a way, yes. And I also noticed when I lived, especially in Switzerland, that not only did even the street sweepers speak five languages, but they had technocratic, ethical people running their government at the local and federal level who were pretty much immune from being bribed or having incentive to bribery, who were trained in governing and vetted for ethics and integrity all the way through their public service. I'm beginning to wonder if America has a chance. What do you think?
I do, Steve, and it's in part because I'm such an old fart. I remember prior to Reagan, you know, Reagan came along and made the comment once, and I've seen it repeated many, many times on right-wing message boards and by right-wing talk show hosts over the years, that there are no smart people in government because government doesn't pay very well. And if you were really smart, you'd be working in industry, and therefore government gets the worst people. That was Reagan's shtick. And prior to Reagan, people went into government because it was public service. It did pay well, and it did provide, you know, job security and a retirement. But prior to Reagan, we respected public service. Post-Reagan, we started dissing public service. So for 40 years now, we've been trashing public service. There still have been a lot of good public servants. And a lot of people feel that call to duty and have answered it. But I think that the Biden administration and the Democratic Party now are putting respect and respectability back into that field. And I think that's a good thing. So I'm very hopeful, Steve, actually. We'll be back with more of the news and more of my thoughts and yours in this kind of national town hall meeting we have here every day on the Tom Hartman program. And in the meantime, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. Never was intended to be. It requires you. So get out there, get active, tag. You're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.